Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I am Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, my Bitcoiners? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, we sit down with Ben and Colin, creators of a website quite often cited on this podcast, WTFHappenedIn1971.com, for a conversation about, what the fuck happened in 1971. First, let's check in with Swan, the sponsor of this episode. The Swan has landed, y'all. We are live in 49 US states. Sorry, New York. We'll make our way through the BitLicense gauntlet eventually. We Bitcoiners talk all the time about dollar cost averaging, about the importance of being Bitcoin only, the dangers of exposing your new coiner, friends, and family to shitcoin scams, why on-ramps need to be good stewards of the blockchain, why quality Bitcoin education is so important to preserving Bitcoin's revolutionary properties of decentralization, censorship resistance, and self-sovereignty. While working on launching Give Bitcoin, our founder Corey Clipston saw the need for a Bitcoiner's Bitcoin on-ramp that meets these aspirations. And so we've built and launched Swan Bitcoin. Automatic recurring buys, automatic withdrawals, the lowest fees in the US for dollar cost averaging, forever Bitcoin only, never any shitcoin temptations for your friends and family. We're dedicated to responsible Bitcoin education. We built Swan to be the best place for Bitcoiners to auto-stack and a service that you can confidently recommend to your family and friends when they are ready to take the plunge down the rabbit hole. So check out Swan Bitcoin today at swanbitcoin.com. All right, let's dive in. Ben and Colin have dedicated a lot of time to studying monetary history, Austrian economics, and Bitcoin. Colin hosts the Bitcoin Echo Chamber podcast, a Bitcoin pod that I listen to and very much respect. And Ben has made many popular appearances on Bitcoin pods, including here on this podcast last summer. They've been nerding out together on this stuff for a long time, and at some point they stumbled upon the WTF happened in 1971 meme and built the website. The site is very simple. It's just about 30 charts that together create a very powerful case that something fundamental changed in 1971 and leaves the viewer compelled to continue their journey answering that question. In this episode, we're going to go on that journey ourselves with the creators of the meme and the site. Let's go. All right, I'm really excited to welcome Ben and Colin, the creators of one of my very favorite websites. I drop it on this podcast all the time. You all know it, WTFHappenedIn1971.com. Simple genius, you guys. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, what's up, Brady?
Yeah, how's it going, guys? You guys doing all right? Let's check in first. Like, how are things going, personally speaking? This is trying times.
I'm doing okay. I'm lucky to be working right now, but yeah, lucky to have savings and lucky to have Bitcoin.
I'm fortunate enough to not have to go into work, but still get paid. So life's been pretty good.
Yeah, same here. Been able to work from home for many years now. And so, yeah, it's job secure. So we're definitely a few of the lucky ones. But yeah, I feel like it's going to get pretty bleak out there. We're just at the beginning of this. What do you guys think is going to happen over the next, few months? This virus thing I've heard is like, it's going to cause, obviously, okay, let's set the virus thing aside. We're not really super qualified, none of us, to really talk about that. But let's talk about the economic impact of, laying off a million people and keeping people inside their homes for a few months. What do you guys see happening? Is this the toppling of the house of cards?
I mean, we're all just sitting around waiting for daddy government to tell us what to do, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I mean, it's like, I think a lot of us have or would, self-isolate anyway, right? And, do we really need, we'll never know like what the alternative, a timeline would have been if the government would have just been like, hey, these are our recommendations, and we hope that you follow them. Here's why. And, let's see what happens instead of like, taking this kind of top-down authoritarian approach.
Yeah, and there was some flip-flopping as far as governmental position on it and the WHO position on, you know, whether people should wear masks. And I think that's what I was trying to hint at. Sometimes maybe I'm a little too subtle with my conceptual understandings of what's happening. But, you know, I think that everyone literally was sitting around waiting for daddy government to tell them what to do. And that message has changed dramatically. And I don't think really the information changed. You know, we had some interesting data in January. And, you know, like you suggest, it, maybe if people weren't sitting around waiting for daddy government to tell them what to do, they would have actually looked into that data themselves. And I think to a lot of Bitcoiners and a lot of people in our space, we're constantly trying to question everything and we're constantly looking at all this different information. And I don't think most people do that because they assume that somebody else is looking out for them. So like you said, it's almost impossible to see how what the world would have responded to, you know, had we not had these paradigms, you know, in place. And another thing that I point to when people are talking about this crisis from the Bitcoiners' perspective is that, you know, if you look at our website here, what the fuck happened in 1971, you'll see the personal savings rate has declined dramatically since then. And that a lot of people don't have any savings today. And that's no secret that, you know, Americans can't afford whatever $400 emergency. And this is a pretty big $400 emergency and a lot more than that. And I really wish, you know, this wasn't happening in, as I said recently on Twitter, peak fiat times. And it's very sad that, you know, a lot of people don't have any savings. So, that's my,
yeah. Colin, what do you, I mean, what's your take on this? Like how bad can this get? Is it going to be really bad in the next couple of years?
I try not to be too much of a pessimist. But I mean, things are kind of bleak. I mean, honestly, you know, how many people out there right now think that life is going to go back to normal in like 2 weeks, 3 weeks? You know, I was talking to someone just yesterday who was like, I had mentioned that I really feel for people that have lost their jobs, you know, because yeah, we're getting checks from the government, what, in a month? I don't know, in a few weeks, who knows? But like, what happens to the people in the meantime? Like, do they lose their homes? Can they feed their families? You know, we don't notice that because we're in our own little bubbles, but like, people out there are probably really suffering. And I was like, I compared this event to the Great Depression. And this person that I was talking to was like, well, it's not as bad as the Great Depression. I mean, the markets haven't crashed. And I was like, are you watching the same markets I have been? And no, I mean, all she does is like sit at home and watch Netflix. And it kind of blows my mind because I'm so insulated in my echo chamber that I forget that like what I spend 90%, 99% of my life paying attention to, other people don't even notice. And, you know, the data is there too. Like you look at retail investing, passive portfolio investors, that hasn't really changed. I mean, like only about 10% of people have actually actively taken money out of the market. Some have increased their contributions and everyone else is kind of just business as usual. And that's pretty bearish. Like when you look at in terms of market sentiment, like the panic hasn't even happened yet. And I think this thing still has a long way to go. And I don't think people understand how, you know, how much of a bubble we were in. Just oil alone, artificially maintaining the price of a global commodity for that long, you know, that the implications of that, the economic damage that that causes due to malinvestment is huge and wide reaching. And, you know, it seems like we're definitely accelerating. We're accelerating the forfeiture of civil liberty. We're accelerating the path of fiat expansion, and it's inevitable. You know, there really is no immediate other option. The government has to print more money. They have to bail out the banks. They have to bail out the hedge funds. They must do this because if they don't, you know, there'd be a riot in Washington D.C. tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They don't have balls to do the right thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, like Colin said, like you just can't at this point. It would be, we're too deep, you know, well, we're just too deep.
It's treating the symptom of the problem with more of the problem, right?
Yeah,
I think.
Right.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and they're going to try to paper over the problem again one more time. And, you know, I think I'm hopeful, not hopeful, but I hope that works. Honestly, I hope it works one more time because I don't think we're ready. Bitcoin's not quite ready.
Right.
We have a lot more education to do, in teaching people what's going on and how to like hold Bitcoin We have a lot more infrastructure, I think, to develop to make that easy. We have a centralization risk right now. You know, if people pile into Bitcoin, it's going to be Coinbase and Kraken and those centralized exchanges, and they're just going to hold up, you know, I think Coinbase already has like 1 million Bitcoin in their custody. And that's, you know, 1/18 of the entire supply. I think I'm right on that number. It's not quite ready yet. And honestly, it's going to be super painful. I'd rather see a little bit more of an easing of the transition, you know, like do it over a little while, you know, 10, 20 years, and let's see like, you know, fiat kind of move into Bitcoin a little bit more slowly. But I'm not sure that's going to happen. I think that, you know, this black swan of the coronavirus may have tipped the top of the house of cards over, and we're just going to have to, you know, deal with this reality. We're at this point now, we're at peak fiat, I think is the way you put it, Ben. We can't do anything else besides print $6 trillion, airdrop, you know, fiat into people's bank accounts. You know, just all kinds of other ways to basically get money into people's pockets. And, you know, this money is going to go to the rich people, the people who are close to the banks, the people on Wall Street. They're going to get bailed out again. It may or may not work. If it does, it's just the cycle's going to happen again in another 10 years or fewer. Here we are. This default changing age, as we like to put it. And how did we get here? Like, how the hell did we get here? It's been like this way for a while. It's been building up for over a century now. And you guys have put together the data in a very simple format for people to read and to look at. And it's a very compelling website. Very simple, but very compelling. So let's go back. I mean, where did this really begin? This peak fiat age that we're at now?
Yeah, the website that we created was a collaboration between Colin and I. It started with a bunch of research I was doing. I started finding all these charts on, you know, what happens when we shifted from what was close to a gold standard to, you know, the fiat standard. And we started like looking at it like, wow, this is actually a pretty dramatic shift. And Colin just kind of asked one day, said, you know, what the fuck happened in 1971, dude? And then he's like, let's make a meme out of that. I was like, you can make a meme? And he's like, yeah, let's make a meme out of it. So we just kind of threw it. That's why I say it was collaboration, because it was based on all this research I did, but it was Colin's early idea. And we had no idea that it would kind of take off the way it has. Not that it's like millions and millions of views yet, but just the many places that we've reached, the many different groups that we've reached is really powerful. And I think a lot of that has to do with our framing of the data. And we've just created the site and we've asked one question. And now more recently, Colin had the idea to create the Twitter account too. And now we're reposting, you know, some of these charts and just asking more questions. And people, like, it's amazing all the answers you get. And then and then we're kind of just, instead of answering more of their questions, we just ask more questions, and we're trying to get people to think. And I think when they see the data and they ask the questions, you know, some may actually go and research it. And we don't actually have Bitcoin mentioned anywhere on the site. But we've been trying to figure out recently how to maybe push people a little bit towards that. So we have the quote from Hayek at the bottom about, you know, the sly roundabout way of getting good money back into the world. So we have this very standoffish approach. And what the fuck happened? I don't know where you want me to start, but I have something to say about all these pieces of data and why it has led to where we are today.
Yeah, I want to go through the charts and kind of, you guys can cherry pick some of your favorites. I always cite the very first chart, the separation of productivity and compensation. We should definitely dive into that one for sure. But I want to go way back to start. Like, let's go before the Federal Reserve was created, right? Mid to late 1800s, we had what was called the Belle Epoque, and it was like a golden age, a short golden age. And why was that referred to as a golden age? What does that mean? What, you know, why is it a golden age?
So we, over the history of mankind, used gold for many thousands of years as money. But I think in the 1800s, the Belle Epoque was when this redeemability of gold, and gold as a global money was the most prevalent, in history. And, you know, the few times, if you're on the website looking, the best chart to look here is the Consumer Price Index, United States, 1775 to 2012. So it's, you know, it's a few hundred years of history here. And you look at the price level over that time, and you can see these tiny little bumps. And what are those? Those are little expansionary episodes. And you notice that, oh, there's a war, there's a war, there's a war. And what happens during wars? Governments tended to kind of borrow, maybe by printing bonds and stuff. And these are kind of natural credit expansions that happen, and they affect the price level a little bit, as you can see. But because there was this constant redeemability of gold, people still, you know, they just use these notes to transact then, that either private banks would issue or that the governments would issue. But there was this redeemability, this gold window at the banks that you could always kind of, that kind of kept them honest. And I think that was that epoch, that gold was, that limited us, that we couldn't print more money.
I think it was more than money too, you know, because we had like this culmination of the spread of information and this massive increase in mechanization of industry, you know, obviously the Industrial Revolution, and you have things like mass production start coming online, interchangeable parts, supply, distribution, transportation, communication. All of these things are like massively changing in the world at that time. Like medical advancements are getting better. People are living longer. Just all kinds of things that dramatically changed society. And also right around that time period, you know, that was kind of like, in my mind, I romanticized those days as like the heyday of free markets. You know, the Western world was coming into its own. That was when you could, you know, if you had an idea and enough hard work in your back, you could go and make something of yourself. You could go and do something and really be successful. And there wasn't a whole lot that could stop you, you know, other than your own knowledge and your own desire to succeed.
And I think like Ben makes a critical point there that I think is lost. Well, just not understood at all. People don't understand what money is anymore, but money was not the paper that the gold was based upon, right? The paper was made to make gold, to represent gold and make it easier to trade back and forth. That was the currency, the paper currency. But the money was the gold. And so where we are now is the currency has become the money, or we treat it as money. But that's kind of the cause of the problem. So in that era, we had, people had were able to bear their own money, and be in control of it. The government couldn't inflate it away nearly as easily, except in extreme circumstances, like wars. And those four bumps in that chart, Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, and then World War I. And then World War II started another little bump, and we just went parabolic from there. That's where it started. Then we have, you know, the creation of the Federal Reserve in the early 1900s, I think it was 1913. You know, after an era like that where the economy was going well, people were being compensated for their effort and work fairly. They were able to, you know, hold on to that wealth to invest it in their own labor and own enterprises. Why did we end up creating the Federal Reserve? Like, how was the political will generated to do that?
So from my understanding, it was sort of a backdoor political manipulation. You know, the way that they framed the creation of the Federal Reserve was, publicly, the people who really wanted it came out against it. And that was a clever manipulation of thought process where people were like, well, if these guys hate it, you know, if the bankers hate it, if the business tycoons hate it, surely it's got to be bad for them. So we're fine with this. Like, let this go through. And the the high level thinking, I guess, of the people who orchestrated the event. You know, they knew exactly what they were doing. I mean, I don't think for a second that, you know, you can go back and see quotes from like Rothschild quotes, right? Like, give me the power of a nation's money and I care not who makes its laws. I mean, these people were for the most part very clear about their intentions. You know, you look at the way Nathan Rothschild handled the English crash, the English market after the Battle of Waterloo. The way he just went and like bought up pretty much all of the debt at the time because he was privy to information that others weren't privy to because of his networks. And I'm certain that the Federal Reserve, they laid the foundation for that. And Woodrow Wilson was also instrumental in this. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, I'm sure guys like Dangerous History would argue that was probably the worst president that the United States ever had because he facilitated this stuff. And he was also a pretty nasty guy too.
So it seems appropriate that the Federal Reserve was sort of born in this backroom dealing. Do you think that then it was, you know, intentional, like the idea that, hey, we can use this, you know, this central bank to manipulate the money supply in our favor and, you know, then therefore like control the country? Do you think that was like an intended outcome of that action?
Yeah, I don't have any doubt in my mind. I mean, like economic panics, they weren't a new thing, right? I mean, you look at like the panic of 1867, you look at the demonetization of silver. These things were going on back like when we were on metal money standards. They weren't new. And the same people back then that were stepping in and intervening were some of the same ones that were involved in the creation of the Federal Reserve. People have understood for centuries, if not longer, that there's power in authority and that there's power in being able to manipulate and especially even in controlling narratives. And I say this a lot, but inflation has always been around. You know, it's just they didn't used to call it inflation, and neo-Keynesian liberal thinking didn't convince people that it was good or necessary for the economy like they do today. They just used to call it coin clipping.
Yeah. The way I say that is that, you know, it's from the ethics of money production that it was like princes used to blush when they were caught coin clipping their coins but causing inflation. But the difference between today and then is that Keynes, through Keynes's writings, they've simply convinced us that inflation, that them stealing from us and debasing, you know, the way that we store our value is a good thing. That is the real shift, and that people ardently defend inflation and say that deflation is the worst thing that could ever happen into an economy, despite the fact that we have all sorts of deflationary economies like the, you know, the electronics industry that I always point to, and that is one of the most booming industries in the world. So I mean, the take, I just don't even understand it. But you know, I do, because there's so much misunderstanding around 1929, and that deflation that was caused then and the pain that was caused then. But
yeah, you look at like the Lionel Robbins economic policy of the time, where he basically said, you know, we're in this depression because of malinvestment. Liquidate the bankers, liquidate the farmers, liquidate. I don't remember the exact quote, but he was just let it all liquidate. And they took that advice for a little bit, and things got really bad. So bad that FDR won the election, and FDR came in with sweeping policy change. I mean, you had the federal government burning oranges, dumping kerosene on produce, so that to try to artificially drive up the prices of the agricultural market while people elsewhere in the country were starving to death. You had the federal government coming in and killing pregnant sows so they wouldn't give birth, so that the livestock population would stay stagnant. I mean, just crazy, crazy banking reforms. Unbelievably unprecedented draconian federal government intervention in a world that so far, you know, the Western world had been used to relatively free markets. I mean, you could argue that bimetallism was a bit of a fiat peg. But this really marked a dramatic shift in the way the federal government intervened with these types of things. And you could probably argue that Lionel Robbins was right, but the liquidation didn't go on far enough. The expansion of money and malinvestment had happened, and they were still paying for it. Like, that's how painful these things get. And that's what we don't really understand today. As we continue to kick this can down the road, we're like, well, you know, we have to print this money. We have to keep this Ponzi going, because if we don't, it's going to be really bad. Well, each time we do that, it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And that's what, like, I'm really afraid of. You know, I know, you know, you go back and look at the Great Depression, you look at the bread lines, you look at just how people lost everything. I mean, I don't want to see that happen, especially not to a worse degree. And it, we're getting there.
Damn, man. Yeah, but I'm with you too. And, like, you know, all of these conversations I've been having, especially since this coronavirus situation, this, the black swan of this illness, have been just dark, dire, ominous. You know, I think that we have brought forward, you know, that eventual future. And so I think, you know, all of us are, you know, afraid for our families and for ourselves and what this could mean.
You've heard that quote about, you know, when the water recedes, you get to find out who's still wearing the swim trunks.
Yeah.
I think the event, you know, itself is the water receding. That's what's happening globally, is that right now, you know, when in the roaring 20s before 1929, everything was great and the water was high and everyone was swimming and playing around. And that was, you know, kind of what happened in the 90s. And that was kind of what happened in, you know, 2017, 2018. Everything's great. Booming economy. No inflation, right? Everything's great. But when the water recedes and you get the black swan event, then you get to find out who's got the swim trunks on. And I think that's what we're seeing now. You know, who had savings, who planned for the future, who had sound investment. And unfortunately, even sound investment, because of this monetary paradigm where we use investment as money, has caused a lot of pain. And it's very sad.
Yeah. I mean, even the people who have, you know, been responsible and saved and looked forward into their future and, you know, anticipated that, you know, black swans will happen at some point. We can't predict when they will, but I want to be prepared for when it does happen. Those people, you know, unfortunately, like, will be subsumed, I think, by the amount of pain and crisis that will be subsumed, because we've kicked the can down the road so many times. Like, you know, if the money becomes absolutely worthless, like, even the most well-prepared are, you know, not going to be able to weather the storm.
Hmm. Yeah.
So this conversation, like the beginning of this, you know, part of the conversation reminded me of this, this quote that I don't think that there's like many of these quotes, like the kind of the original person who spoke it or wrote it is often kind of lost to history and they get misattributed. But the quote is, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws." This is, I think it comes from the like early to mid 1800s is the original source. It looks like 1838, and it's been attributed to one of the Rothschilds' ancestors, the Rothschilds who Colin was referring to, their ancestors. So that knowledge, that idea was already there. And, you know, the founding fathers wrote about this a lot, right? And, you know, were very, very adamant that the control of the money was not in the hands of the government.
Yeah, isn't there, I don't remember what the, where it exists, but there's a law, something along the lines of no state shall issue any money that is not gold or silver.
That's a constitutional amendment.
The constitutional amendment.
A constitutional law, yeah.
And the way they got around that was by creating a federal body, so not a state, that can issue money. And it's just like, it's almost like they tried to plan for this stuff, you know, and there's all the quotes about Jefferson, that banks are more powerful than standing armies. And
and they learned those lessons the hard way too. Like the phrase, not worth a continental, that's actually rooted in early like continental colony hyperinflation, because they would just print money to try to support their lifestyles. Like, you had all these different colonies that had all of their own currencies, and they were not very liquid, and they were really difficult to trade with outside of that colony. And those colonies would often print way too much of it because they didn't understand the economic implications. And that's where that phrase, not worth a continental, actually comes from, because so many of those continental dollars just became completely worthless. So the federal, the founding fathers, you know, like they understood money very well, like particularly Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Those guys were the Democratic Republican thinkers. You know, the Federalists tended to be a little bit less on the hardcore like monetary theorist side, but even guys like so what a lot of times happened was they wanted to use federal national bank funding to fund things like wars. And Madison ran into this problem during the quasi-wars where he just couldn't pay for the war at the federal level and had expected the states to step up and provide their infantry to help fight the French and also again the British in the War of 1812. And they just couldn't do it. And it was because Jefferson had abolished the central bank. So Madison had to charter a new central bank, and he didn't want to do that. He was forced to, but they understood the moral hazards that were created by doing so.
Yeah, I think it's a really sad story, really, because, you know, gold was so interwoven into our society for such a good reason. And as Nick Szabo talks about, gold has severe flaws. You know, it was the best money, because of its hardness and, you know, all these things that most of us understand very well now, but it was its, you know, physical locality as a necessary for transaction that required us to kind of use paper and all these other devices in order to scale it. And that was what led to, you know, us kind of just abandoning gold in so many different ways and in so many different times. But then the culmination of that really happened in 1971. And, you know, we're trying to go through this entire history of how all this slowly happened. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that us leaving that gold standard and just eventually printing, you know, pieces of paper was almost inevitable. It's mm-hmm. And you know, as Colin has said to me, and it just kind of rocked my world when he said gold failed as money. Gold already failed, and it's never coming back, unfortunately. The gold bugs are so diluted that they, you know, they're giant heavy gold bags that they're like, no, see, for 5,000 years gold was great. Well, life was a lot different back then, and, you know, our need to transact globally instantaneously because of where society is today has way overshadowed that Lindy effect. And, you know, I think all of us agree that, you know, Bitcoin is the only thing that can fill that role today because of this, you know, this magic property. It's this, as Satoshi described it, this gray elemental metal that, you know, wasn't particularly ductile or particularly strong or even conductive, but it has this magical property that it can be transacted over a communications channel. And that changes everything. And that's why what the fuck happened in 2009 is so important. Because that's where we are today.
yeah, exactly. So, okay, let's go back real quick to the Great Depression era, because what you reminded me of when you're talking there about how gold failed, it, you know, ultimately it culminated in Nixon taking us off the gold standard in 1971. I think another you know, inflection point in the, you know, the capture of gold and money, the complete control of money, was again, you know, FDR, you know, confiscating all the gold, right? And that just gets to the point on the physicality of it, the locality of it, how susceptible gold is and was to confiscation by governments and complete centralization of that power.
Right. Yeah. Executive Order 6102 made it illegal for U.S. citizens to hold gold on their person or in their homes, and you know, it's much easier to go back in time and ask people that are still alive today, like, hey, what was it like when Nixon ended the gold standard in 1971? Most people will tell you that, like, it was a non-event. It didn't impact their life whatsoever. Most people didn't even pay attention to it, didn't even notice, because they were already used to using paper as money. You know, the fact that they can't go and exchange it at the treasury for gold. So what? I mean, why do they need gold? They have a paper. The paper's just as good. In fact, it's easier. It's better. I don't know. You know, it'd be interesting to try to find some historical perspective on what people thought of that when it happened. You know, because that was much closer to gold as money than they were in the 70s. You know, gold had already been abstracted away from money for so long by the time Nixon closed the gold window. But you have to wonder, like, what people were thinking. You know, they must have been burying gold in their fields and hiding gold in their floorboards and behind the walls, because I guarantee you they had to have a better understanding of that. But then at the same time, you know, people were willing to put up with FDR's draconian policy because they were desperate. You know, I mean, like I said, people lost a lot in the Great Depression. And back then, a very small percentage of people even had money in the stock market.
Mm-hmm. We're taught that the, you know, Great Depression was ended by FDR and the New Deal. And without those actions by the government, you know, it would have descended into absolute chaos. Would have been the end of the union. What
deflationary spiral, right?
Right, the deflationary spiral. Yeah, it would be inescapable, like some kind of economic black hole, and it would destroy everything. Like I said, that's what's taught now, and that is the understanding of that's predominant. You know, when I talk to people, you know, and that was my understanding too before Bitcoin, because I was taught that in college. And, you know, I remember having this conversation early in my Bitcoin rabbit hole journey with another, you know, really, like a really smart dude who, you know, he's been in the business world for a long time, finance world. He knows money, like the current version of money. And he got to the point where he was like very mad, like yelling at me about how, you know, gold caused the Great Depression and FDR and the seizing of gold and the moving on to, you know, the US dollar and the control of the money by the government is what brought us out of the Great Depression, and we wouldn't be here today if we didn't have that. And he was like, that happened over and over again too. You see every you know, financial crisis since then, governments have been able to, you know, pull us out of that by having control of the money.
Yeah, and you could probably go and open a history textbook right now and find that narrative. But if you go back and study the data yourself, it's just simply not true. I mean, there was money expansion in the 20s, and it caused an economic boom. I mean, that they called it the Roaring 20s for a reason. Life was good. You know, the tide was high. Everybody was swimming, like Ben said. And then when the tide went out, you know, that was when things got bad. The malinvestment got so bad that it started to liquidate. And when it started to liquidate, it had cascading effects. And you know, don't assume that just because they were on, that it wasn't fiat money, that there couldn't have been an expansion of the money supply. Don't forget that bimetallism is fiat money. Coin clipping is money expansion. And even then, they were using paper notes, right? Right. Who was holding the central banks accountable then? You know, it's the same problem that we've always had, trusted third parties. You know, you can always expect human beings to act in their own best interest. And sometimes someone else's immediate best interest is not what's in your best interest. And if you're the one controlling the money spigot, you know, you're not really going to think too much about the long-term implications of what you're doing or how it's going to affect society as a whole, because you don't care. You're going to be insulated from those effects.
It's pretty insidious to blame gold, the hard money, for, you know, the actions of the expansionists, in my opinion, because mm-hmm. people retreated to hard money, and that allowed the water, that drained the water out of the sea by exposing their lies and their expansionary malinvestment. And then people just going into gold, the hard money, that's going to cause pain. And we might, unfortunately, see something similar to that if people flood into Bitcoin at some point, and they'll blame it on Bitcoin that they can't do all their inflationary magic anymore. And that also makes me sad. But
think that this is kind of part of what Ben and I had in mind when we formed this meme. is because, you know, we've spent a lot of our own time and energy studying these things independently. We weren't, Ben and I are the type of people, like, we don't take the answers that we're given in the textbooks. Like, we don't just go off of what we learned in school or what the people on TV say. We like to go and try to find firsthand sources. We like to put the pieces together ourselves and say, well, is what we're being told the real story? And quickly, when you study economics, you learn that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, that there's a lot of misdirection. And well, you know, to kind of circle back to what we were talking about at the beginning, when Ben and I were studying the Nixon shock, and we were just like, wow, like, there's so many economic anomalies. Like, you just look at so many charts at 1971 and they just all go crazy. Wouldn't it be interesting if we just had, like, somewhere you could go where you could see all of this in one place, like, where you could just easily see, because you can see by looking at our website, we've pulled that data from tons of different sources. You can't, mm-hmm. there was nowhere to go where you could just say, like, I just want to see all of the crazy things that happened, you know, that economists would find. Neo-Keynesian economists would find a million reasons to blame on other things rather than going off the gold standard. And it was kind of just like, well, let's just see what we can find and put it all in one place. And then the meme kind of just emerged, because we know, you know, like, me, you, and Ben, and probably a lot of your listeners, we know what the fuck happened in 1971 because we've studied these things. But do most people, you know, from what we've seen, not really. I mean, a lot of people do. And the question is intentionally rhetorical. Like, what the fuck happened in 1971? We're not asking because we know what happened in 1971, but mm-hmm. do you?
And by phrasing it this way, by not providing the answers, you know, we've talked over and over again about, hey, should we do a write-up in explaining all these things? By not doing that, by not providing mm-hmm. any additional information, it's our sly roundabout way of making people do their own research and asking these questions over and over again and constantly, persistently, just only asking questions. It forces people. And, you know, not everyone's going to find their way to Bitcoin from it, but at least we've got them to think. So,
yeah. All right. So we're up to 1971. We've talked about, you know, the last era of really, you know, a solid gold standard in the United States, what it was like then. We talked about the Federal Reserve, the Great Depression, and then we get up to finally the culmination of the end of hard money and the beginning of the fiat age, the full fiat age, 100% fiat age in 1971. Let's go through some of the charts and what's happened between 1971 and now. Like I said earlier, you know, my favorite chart that I love to reference is basically the chart that describes time theft. That our productivity has increased dramatically since 1971. It's up 246% since, I guess that's since 1948, right? And another, you know, 150% since 1971. And since 1971, compensation is only up about 25%, right? So like roughly 150% increase in productivity since 1971. And a 25% increase in compensation. It's basically flatlined. And so what that culminates to in is basically the theft of our time, of our, you know, productivity is a measure of time, a measure of work in an amount of time. We can get more work done in a shorter amount of time. We're saving ourselves time, therefore, which should be used for other pursuits, family time, other projects that we're interested in, whatever. But it can't be because our wages have been stagnant since then. And so therefore, the end analysis is that literally the fiat age is stealing our time from us.
Yeah, and it's what this chart doesn't show. I mean, yes, it's a theft of our time, but it's also the theft of the progress of society, right? Yeah. As we get better at making things, they should be cheaper to make, and we can make more of them or make higher quality things for the same price. But what this chart doesn't show you is inflation. There's no inflation in this chart because the compensation is real wages, real compensation.
Right.
What's happening here, in my opinion, is that when the prices begin to rise more quickly, it becomes harder because if prices are rising, you have to secure more wages every year, and not only that. But your any savings that you have also dwindle at a faster rate. So it becomes this treadmill that increased, you know, dramatically in that year, 1971. And the next chart is kind of the exact same story without the productivity part, because you see GDP keeps going up. So we keep making more stuff. We keep transacting more stuff. It's real GDP. But the wages, again, you'd have to you have to keep securing more and more wages in order to fight this current that is just keeping you back. And I think that has led to a lot of wealth inequality, and it's led to people using, you know, in my research as well, I learned a lot about the euro dollar rabbit hole. And it's so fascinating, because you can see at a systemic level what these banks use for money is not dollars. They use other things. It's the moneyness of other objects. Oh, so many different objects have moneyness to them. You know, if you remember the monetary history, rocks and beads and, you know, all these different things were used as money, feathers and shells. And why do we use gold? Because it's harder money than those things. And when we had to learn the hard way. But we've learned today that dollars are not good at a long-term money. So we use other things as money. We use assets, and we use mortgage-backed securities as money. And that was all starting to happen in the 50s and 60s. And if you look at the price level in the 50s and 60s, that's when it really starts to creep up, before 1971. But I don't know why, but I find that so fascinating, that we rely on the moneyness of other things because our money is so bad at being money, that banks don't use money as money. They use it to expand the money supply so they can, I don't know.
The store of value property of money has died with, yes, you know, when you have in the fiat age. And so we seek stores of value in other assets, you know. Real estate, of course, is an example that we use often. And it's, you know, led to the real estate bubble of 2008, 2009. Insane right. Mortgages being you know, passed by or authored and accepted by banks.
And it creates this problem too. I'm sorry to cut you off there. I think I got what I was trying to get to before. Mm-hmm. Is it creates this problem when you use all these other things as money. Well, when you really need money, like in a time of a global crisis, that we now have to rip our wealth out of all of those things very quickly, which causes a lot of pain and a lot of issues. You know, Connor Brown has talked about that Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, and that's a great thing. And this kind of is part of that when we are forced to use all these other things as money, like stocks and real estate, that we interrupt and disrupt the economic uses of those things for what they are good for. I'm not against stocks. Don't get me wrong. Stocks are a fantastic way for, you know, somebody to acquire some equity in a growing business, especially a sound investment. But we know about, you know, how bad money makes poor investment because of this idea of malinvestment. But this disruption of all these economic devices has left us, I think, in a very poor situation today, because nobody knows which money to be in at any given time, because we don't have good money.
Colin, what's one of these charts here on WTF happened in 1971.com that, you know, you like to go to as an illustration of, you know, this fiat age that we're in?
I really am fascinated by the second order effects. Look at the one about the incarceration rates. You know, we get some of our biggest pushback is specifically some charts, and then also people that are like, oh, well, you know, you can't look at these second order effects without taking extraneous factors into account. Like the divorce rate one. Yeah, we know that there were no fault divorce laws that were passed in the 70s. Like, we understand that that has impacts on those types of things. But, you know, you look at the data today, and what's the number one thing people fight about in their marriages? It's money, right? I mean, yes, there are other contributing factors to some of these things. Like, yes, the war on drugs obviously increased the amount of federal incarceration. But you got to go deeper on these things. Like, how does the government afford to finance this war on drugs? How did this continual expansion of government debt that we see, how do they continue to do it without risk of default, right? I mean, we see this kind of like trickle down, and this also goes back to like the theft of our productivity, the theft of our progress. Because whenever the government takes out all this debt and uses it to do other things, that's capital that we're giving up today, right? That's capital that we could have spent, like same thing with taxes. That's capital that you could have invested in a business or spent on a sandwich or like just done, spent to do anything that you want to do here and now or save for the future, but you can't because it's been reallocated to something else. And you look at the amount of waste in our society, the amount of bureaucratic nonsense that contributes nothing to anything. Yeah. So often in my life, I've found myself doing something and just thinking, what am I doing? Like, why am I doing, why do I have to do this? This, nobody cares about this. Like no individual anywhere cares that this gets accomplished. It doesn't impact anybody's life. It doesn't improve my life. But there's so much of it. It's everywhere. There's all this bloat and there's all these, like everything feels like a lie. It feels very fake. And you know, you got to wonder, like, when you see a chart like the incarceration rate in 1971 and it just goes parabolic, like, is that necessarily a good thing for society? Maybe society has a lot of people that need to get locked up. But I think that the answer is more so in misallocation of capital.
You know, when you're talking about the divorce rate thing, I thought of something too, Colin, that kind of echoes something I've heard you talk about before. You said, what is the thing most people fight about in money? I agree with you. I think the second most thing that people fight about is infidelity, right? But did we get more promiscuous as a society at that time? I don't think so. You know, that didn't change, right? So what did change?
What the fuck happened?
it's the same thing. You know, we see this a lot because it's, like I said, the rhetorical question. What I've found out, we can reverse track hits on our website and follow the conversations back to where we're getting people coming to us from. And you'll find like conversations on places all over the internet, like 4chan and like random forums that you would never expect people are talking about this on, like sports forums, law school admission forums, like Facebook groups, like all kinds of just random places where people are talking about WTF happened in 1971. And obviously you get a lot of conjecture and, you know, you'll see people blame like the sexual revolution or like, the invention of credit cards or like greed, you know, and it's like, did we not have, like, what I always ask those people is, did we not have greed before 1971? I mean, is that what changed? Like we just all suddenly became greedy overnight. It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. And the credit card question seems compelling at first on face. I could see that being something that'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. That would be a big cause, but really that's just a tool for, you know, basically accessing the debt that fiat age brings on. Right. So it's like, it's the currency is debt based right now. It's not an asset based. It's like Bitcoin is or gold was. The whole economy is driven on debt now, and the value of the money itself is debt. It's literally generated by the Federal Reserve and made into notes that we can trade around. So we're trading debt. Credit cards just make that, you know, little, it puts a nice UX on top of that, and that's all.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, and there's other ones too. Like people blame it on. I've heard peak oil. I mean, give me a break. Like we pull more oil out of the earth today than we ever have. Well, maybe not like today, but maybe 2 months ago.
Right.
And the oil crisis in the 70s and in the 80s. And then like the Vietnam War, I've had people blame that. I've heard people even blame like the opening of Disney World and liberalization of education, like all these types of things that, yes, those are problems and maybe indirectly contribute to the breakdown of our cultural relativism, but
you'd expect to see a bump from those things. You'd expect to see, you know, a bump in the road if one of those things is really bad. And the oil thing, for example, there was this giant spike in oil prices right about in 1971 too. That's why it was a really interesting response to me. But you shouldn't see a paradigm shift in all of society where everything keeps getting worse and worse and worse forever because of like one little thing. Obviously, the Disneyland thing is completely stupid, but Disneyland's still here. But oil prices spiked then, and then they kind of went back down again. So it's like, why would that still be affecting all these things later on? You know, many, many years and this trend that just starts, and it's so abrupt in so many of these charts at exactly that time. So That's why I think it's silly.
There's a lot of other data that we'd like to include because it seems like it would be something that's increased a lot in 1971, but like it has like lag effects or like long-term tail effects. Like mortgage debt is probably a good one. There are a lot that don't show an abrupt shift in 1971. It maybe took a decade, or it maybe took like 15 years or 20 years. And we can't, you know, we could probably attribute it to monetary expansion, but we want to show, you know, we want to keep the meme intact. We want to show data that's so compelling at a glance that you're like, what the fuck happened in 1971?
Yeah. And so you go and continue researching on your own. Like you guys said, another second order effect that you have here below incarceration rates is share of 25 to 29 year olds living with parents or grandparents. And it's gone from, you know, about 12% in 1971 up to over 33%, 32, 33% in 2015, 2016. I mean, that's crazy. And it's, you know, again, another absolutely clear on the nose inflection point, 1971. Millennials, you know, get a bad rap for this, right? They're just, you know, like boomers will make fun of them for being lazy. Why don't you get a job? Why are you living at home? You're skimming off your parents. When I was young, I had a job and, you know, started working when I was 16 and moved out of my house when I was 17, 18, started making my own way, paid myself through college, et cetera, et cetera.
On a McDonald's salary.
Exactly, right? On a McDonald's salary or stocking shelves or something, right? You put yourself through college stocking shelves. My dad put himself through college stocking shelves at a shoe store. Like, didn't have to take out any loans.
And you know what you bring up there, Brady, is why it's so hard to talk to boomers and even Gen X to a certain degree about these problems. Because you have here the early entrance in a global Ponzi scheme. You know, how can you explain to somebody who's benefited from inflation their entire life that inflation is the cause of all of your society's problems?
Or the cause of all of your success.
Right. And who do the boomers think is going to show up and buy their assets off of them so they can retire? When the millennials are, and now, you know, Gen Z are entering the workforce with $100,000, $150,000 in student loans, useless college degrees, no life experience, like liberalized watered down educations, no understanding of money, no understanding of planning for the future. That's what we're churning out. And how do they, like, at a certain point, you know, the buck's got to stop, like the party's over. No one's going to show up to buy your investments from you because they're not going to be able to afford to.
Malinvestments, where the borrowing from society, and we are left with the bill. My generation is left with the bill, because borrowing is to borrow from the future and to spend it now. And it was spent on all those boomers and spent on all those assets. And now, you know, who's paying the bill? The Federal Reserve is printing more money to pay for the bill, and it will have enormous effects on all society, I think. You know, I mean, I often look at Japan because I think they're the fiat endgame kind of case study that we can look at. And, oh, Lord, their central banks own, what is it, half the stock market or something now?
Yeah, BOJ is the number one equity holder in Japan.
And that seems like it's getting more and more of a real possibility that the Federal Reserve is going to be doing something similar. And I don't know. It makes me a little wary because I feel like that's yet again another unprecedented thing, and we're seeing negative interest rates, and it's like nobody knows what's going to happen, and there's so much uncertainty, and I attribute it all to this one year. It makes me sad.
Yeah. All right. Last chart on that I want to bring up is. Next, it's the penultimate chart, the next last chart on the page. Interest rates since 3000 BC, which, first of all, I want to know who found information about the interest rates of 3000 BC. That's amazing.
The Bank of England.
They found that, the interest rates? They found that data?
That's where it says the sources from. I don't know. I didn't make it.
Okay. Chart. Yeah, gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I didn't see that down there. Yeah. So, all right. 3000 BC, apparently, interest rate was around 20%, but by 380, it falls down to about 4%, and then, you know, sits there for 1400 years in the 4-6% range. And then, you know, well, basically, yeah, actually more like 1600 years, the 4-6% range, dips down in leading up to the Great Depression, then goes parabolic up to, you know, the late 70s and early 80s. 14, 15, 16%, literally unprecedented since 3000 BC, you know, interest rate levels, and then has, you know, dropped precipitously since then to negative interest rates we see all over the world, 0% interest rates in the United States, probably headed toward negative interest rates at some point. How does that happen? Why? Like, that is an absolutely incredible aberration in history on both sides, to the upside and the downside.
I completely agree. And, you know, very similar to if you look at the price level over time chart, that if you look at this chart over time, if you do a little bit of blurring and you try to see what the trends are, it seems like the trend long term from many thousands of years ago until right around, if you mark, I mean, I've marked 1971 on here, but if you mark 1913, when they established the Federal Reserve, well, there's a giant dip. And then there's this giant climb up a mountain. And then in 1971, it keeps going. And then after that, it can never get higher again. It must always fall. And that's what I'm talking about, is that there are these paradigm shifts in our monetary history. And I think that is what has happened here. They aren't able to raise interest rates because we know what happens every single time they do. The stock market sells off, and that's the wealth of the, you know, the wealthiest 1% who have the most influence over the people who control these things, because they, you know, they contribute to their domain or their campaigns, and they, you know, they're closest to these people that they can't afford to lose all that stuff. And again, that's the second order effect of the fact that they need to use these assets as money. It's a scary world of negative interest rates, because again, it's the unknown. And it seems we've been forced into that because they need to keep expanding, because the addiction of inflation is a terrible, terrible disease. But I don't know what happens if we all go full negative interest rates, because I think it breaks all the whole concept of lending money in at all. Because, you know, why would I lend money if the Federal Reserve is lending money at negative interest? I'm certainly not going to do it at negative interest. I'm not going to – sorry, Brady, I like you. But I'm not going to pay you to take my money, you know. It's so sad that it seems – you know, I think I've said it before that the temptation to create money is too great to be ignored. And, that, you know, that's why we all believe in Bitcoin, because there is no – way to inflate the supply. I mean, you can, if you'd like to go create, you know, Bitcoin 2, have fun with that. You know, we're all going to keep hanging out over here and doing our thing. But, you know, when the incentives aren't aligned, when you know, like we said, that the severe flaws of gold just put us along this path, you can attribute this stuff to, oh, it's this giant, you know, government conspiracy that just created this. But, you know, I think it's just kind of a sad history of poor money, and that hopefully, eventually, Bitcoin can seep its way into the world and prevent these things from happening. But it's a long road ahead, I think.
Yeah, I was talking to Francis Puglio earlier on our Swan Signal Live that we do every Wednesday, live on our Twitter handle. And he had an interesting take on like the sort of phases that Bitcoin is going through. Prototype phase, which was sort of like until 2013, 2014. And then we have the bootstrap phase, 2015 through now. Maybe we're kind of coming into toward the end of the bootstrap phase. You know, maybe in the middle of the bootstrap phase, who knows? I mean, we still have infrastructure left to build. But then phase two is hyper-Bitcoinization. Like Bitcoin sucks in the, you know, monetary, like the value of the dollar, the monetary premium and all these assets. And then the next phase before, you know, you don't just transition into a Bitcoin era, is similar to what we were talking about with the dollar, right? You get to a point where there's just no demand for the assets you're holding, right? And no one's going to buy your assets. They all become worthless. Is this what he calls a fallout era, a fallout phase, where, you know, Bitcoin is, you don't want to, basically, it's, no one wants to sell their Bitcoin for quite a while because it's obviously it's the most, you know, valuable asset. No one really wants to lend it at any interest rate because the markets haven't been reestablished yet, you know? And so there's this period of extreme inequality until, you know, slowly the markets, you know, tend to start to reform on this new money, this new sound money. But that will take, you know, take a while. And then, you know, the final phase is this, you know, this Bitcoin based economy, a Bitcoin era.
Yeah, it's almost very similar to this idea that, you know, inflation is this thing that that keeps going on, and that, you know, the longer we delay, you know, a return to reality, the harder that happens, the harder it is to return to it. And it seems to me that we've been away from sound money for so long that the return to real sound money, and when that water recedes, is going to be painful no matter what. And I think that's kind of sad. And I think, you know, Bitcoiners have talked about this in many different ways. You know, what does the hyper Bitcoinization event have? What does it look like for people? And it's hard because it's easy for somebody to point to that doesn't do all this research, doesn't kind of, you know, hang in our circles, that they're going to say, oh, well, see, Bitcoin caused this. And to me, that's the same person as pointing at gold caused the 1929 depression. And obviously, that's diluted if you understand the things that we've kind of been trying to explain here. But maybe the way to look at it, if you want to be positive about it, is that we must return to sound money to get back to a sound society and to have sound investments. And that the longer we delay that, the worse that transition is going to be. I think it also makes the case for, we don't need Wen Moon to happen tomorrow. And that if it happens a little more slowly, that's maybe not necessarily a bad thing. I think I heard Andreas talk about how it's, you know, if Bitcoin is this lifeboat and, the world is the Titanic, maybe not everybody pile onto the tiny little lifeboat all at the same time. Maybe let's keep building it out very slowly and let it build liquidity so that it can handle all these people, you know?
I get that. I agree with you. So we lost Colin. I was kind of waiting for him to pop back in.
He's gonna pop back in right now.
Good.
Nice. He lost power.
Oh my God. Well, that'll set you back for a few minutes. So I wanted to ask you guys about, like, and we can get Colin's take when he pops back in, but I wanted to ask you if you guys had thought about doing anything else with the meme. Like, I think the page is perfect the way it is. The simplicity is, you know, its greatest, you know, asset. It's just super powerful that way. But the meme is very powerful as well. And I think I think it's sort of like it's a meme that's like a prerequisite for diving down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and really getting into all of those memes, the rest of the Bitcoin memes, because it describes the problem with money, which you need to understand before you, you know, are able to see the value of Bitcoin. And so I think the meme is extremely valuable and important. So have you guys thought about, you know, other ways to get this out into the mass consciousness?
We've discussed a number of times, and it's tough because, you know, as I've described, if you write all this stuff about it, then it kind of destroys the meme. The beauty of the meme is that it's just a bunch of data and a bunch of questions, and it allows the reader to kind of draw his own conclusions. We've also discussed making a documentary, which would be a huge undertaking, and securing funding for which would require a lot of work. And, especially in these times, getting funding for such an extravagant project would be difficult. And, I think we were talking to American HODL about doing it. I think you might have even been in on that, weren't you?
I was in that conversation.
And it's, you know, we'd want to do it right if we did it. So we've also talked about, you know, maybe making a merchandise store just to kind of spread the meme around. But I don't know, man. It's really interesting to have just watched, you know, made the site and shared it on Twitter a few times, and then to see how many, you know, how many different people are slowly like, oh, yo, what is that thing? And I don't know, man. We're kind of just going with the flow right now, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
I think you're right. Like, I think you know, there's plenty, like, the writing medium is, the text medium is basically there. Like, all of these charts lead back to a bunch of literature that you can read and dive into and really understand. A lot of people won't do that, right? A lot of people aren't, you know, driven to really spend a ton of time digging through a bunch of source literature. Like we are, there are, you know, a lot of people that are, but very, I think they're very, you know, low percentage of the population in general. So I think a documentary is perfect, right? I think the merchandise is good too, because it'll drive people to the site. I think just like the power is, you know, the what the fuck meme, the WTF meme is like being leveraged here, right? And so that'll capture people's attention. Like, they'll see WTF, what is that about? Like, what the fuck happened in 1971? That's going to capture people's attention right away. People love that meme and are used to it. So I think on merch is great, but the documentary, I think, is really where it can shine, right? Like, imagine if there was a WTF happened 1971 documentary on Netflix right now, while everyone's like chilling at home, you know, looking for something to watch. They're done with the Tiger King. They're like, I'm, you know, I just can't take any more of this, like, you know, just crap. I want to watch something that's, you know, interesting, and have that up there at the front, like promoted, be like, you know, I would click on it. I think most people would click on it, right? It's an interesting idea. And it's a very visual medium, which would correspond well, you know, to the site, which is, you know, completely visual. So,
well, if any of the OG Bitcoiners that bought in 2010 and have money to burn are sitting around waiting how to figure out how to make hyper Bitcoinization happen, and they want to reach out to us and fund our movie, we're looking for, like, I think American Hodel said 200K. To make the documentary, and
as a minimum,
and but we're here. Feel free to reach out to us. We can involve you in the process. I don't know.
So I don't know what all you guys covered while I dropped out of the call, but in regards to the broader conceptual idea of the meme, you know, it kind of, like I said, it started out of Ben and I just saying, wouldn't it be cool if there was one place you could go to see all this data? And then, you know, the idea of the meme kind of took hold, and we found ourselves constantly saying, well, we don't want to hurt the meme. Like, we've got to keep the meme intact. Everything that we do, like, we're constantly revising the data, trying to find, like, better data to present and make sure that we're presenting things that we think at least are relevant. But we always are, the conversation is always, well, we've got to keep the meme intact. Because really, you know, all, like, most Bitcoiners that I know, not all of them, but a lot of, like, the smarter ones, they love monetary economics. They're so passionate about it, as they should be, because it's super interesting. It's literally, like, the most interesting topic that I've ever found in my life. It consumes so much of my mental energy. I mean, you should see Ben and I's DMs. We are literally back and forth, like, discussing theory and history, like, 24/7. It's the nerdiest thing you will ever see in your life. And we feel this way because we see how important it is, because we understand the greater contextual history. How do you get somebody who has no interest in economics whatsoever? They took an economics class in high school and slept through it to care about these things. You really can't. I mean, you can't just, like, walk up to them and start spouting off about, like, you know, credit default swaps and expect them to care. Like, you just can't. And most people, even if you expose them to the best information, they're going to start to drift off and fall asleep and not pay attention. How do you meme economic understanding into the collective consciousness? How do you get an entire generation of people who you can't get away to look away from their iPhones for 5 minutes to care about hundreds of years of economic history? Ben and I think it's Socratic self-discovery. We think that if you ask people the right questions, right, then that's going to cause them to start asking questions. You can't make people care about something, but if you can trigger the right thought processes, you can get them to start to think about it. And that can cause, like, a waterfall cascade of thought processes that might eventually lead them to Bitcoin. So if we can keep the meme intact, and if we can present a compelling data set that just gets people saying, huh, what the fuck did happen in 1971? Then, you know, you might end up forging the next Bitcoiner. I mean, 2008 is what got me into Austrian economics. I started with End the Fed. That led me to The Creature from Jekyll Island, and that led me down the Austrian rabbit hole. And in tandem with the Austrian rabbit hole is how I kind of came to understand Bitcoin. And I really think, like, even this economic crisis that we're having today is going to drive a whole new generation of young people like myself. You know, I was just coming out of high school in 2008 to the same rabbit hole of research that I've been down. And if my website can play a small part in planting those seeds, I think that that's really what it's all about.
You're here, man. I think that's a great place to wrap it up. Yeah, I appreciate you guys' work. I love your podcast, Colin. Listen to it all the time. Ben, you know, love having you on my podcast.
Well, we really appreciate you shilling our website on every single episode for the past 20 episodes in a row.
Right? I can't help it. You know, that's organic growth right there. That's just testament to what you guys have done. So appreciate it.
Well, that's a high compliment, man. Cause Ben and I have imposter syndrome. We're constantly like, dude, like we're just two random dudes. Like, why do people take us so seriously?
Oh, dude, I'm right there with you, man. I think a lot of us do.
Well, what I think is for sure is that all three of us are sitting here together at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance.
I love it, man. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, man.
Thanks to Ben and Colin for joining me. Let us know your thoughts about the episode. Ben is at Mr. Cool BP, at MRCOOLBP. And Colin is at Heavily Armed C, stands for Heavily Armed Clown, on Bitcoin Twitter. Of course, I am at Citizen Bitcoin on Twitter as well. And that's the best way to support the podcast. Share it out on Bitcoin Twitter. I notice when you guys share it out. I really appreciate it every time. Try to engage with you. Let everyone know what you loved about the episode, you know, a quote, something you disagreed with. Just love seeing that kind of engagement on Twitter. Really helps, and I, you know, definitely notice and appreciate it. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. You can share that with friends and family. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode and to LTBN for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in their feed. Check out my merchandise store at layer1btc.com. You can click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's a lot of cool stuff there. Shout out to designer and Bitcoiner Nick Ward. And check out the podcast I've created for Swan, the Swan Signal Podcast. It's an audio archive of our weekly Swan Signal live broadcasts. A group of Bitcoiners getting together, hanging out, talking Bitcoin every week. You can subscribe at swansignalpodcast.com. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. My DMs are always open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram and Keybase. And my email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.